Welcome, listeners, to another episode of the Arc and Anth podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Rivera, and I hope you've all had a wonderful week so far. This is the podcast all about the human condition, human behavior, and the human past. Today's guest is wonderful archaeologist, Dr. Justin Dunavant. Justin, are you there?
I'm here. Yes, thank you.
Welcome to the show, Justin. This is really great to be speaking to you. Where are you calling in from?
I'm calling in right now from Nashville, Tennessee.
Oh, great. Is that where you're normally based?
Yeah, I'm currently based on a postdoc at Vanderbilt University right now. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I've been in Nashville since August.
Oh, cool. Is it a very large department that you are with at your institution?
No, it's a pretty intimate department. There's really a focus more so in Andean and Mesoamerican archaeology, but they made some space for Caribbean archaeologists.
Great. So from what I gather on social media, you seem to also have been traveling quite a lot recently, at least in 2019 for work, attending various events or presenting in different places. Is all of this travel sort of how your life goes generally, always moving around?
Yeah, really. I guess the last year and a half, it's sort of been a lot of travel for a lot of different things. Mm-hmm. So in addition to doing this postdoc, I contract with the National Museum of African American History and Culture, and specifically with the Slave Wrecks Project. So in addition to doing my research, I'm also working with them on a number of projects. And then also working as president, co-founder of Society of Black Archaeologists. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of travel at the moment. Hopefully it doesn't continue for too much longer.
Yeah. There's a big elephant in the room, I guess. Is the present situation with the coronavirus going to affect your work in any way?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we've already canceled most of our programming for the summer. And we're looking at trying to see if we can even reschedule for the fall, or if we need to actually hold off until possibly the end of this year or next year. Mm-hmm. This definitely had a big impact on how things are moving forward.
Yeah, that's really tough. I imagine you're quite passionate about, doing archaeology is quite physical field that we do, where, we get to hold objects and we get to excavate, interact with students maybe. So I can imagine that's quite tough.
Right. Yeah, our prayers go out to the families, just making sure that everybody's okay. And then, we had a number of training programs set up. So now we're trying to figure out how, if at all, we can still get training for some of these undergraduate students while still sort of dealing with this situation. Mm-hmm.
So within broader archaeology, there's all of human history and so many different aspects of human life that archaeologists concern themselves with. In a very wide sense, how would you describe your own collective body of work so far?
Yeah, that's a good question. So really, I guess my entry point into archaeology has always been trying to better understand the history and culture of the African diaspora. And as a result of that, most of my research has focused both in Africa as well as the Caribbean, and different parts of the continent as well, and dealing with research questions related to that. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I've been more adamant about more recently is trying to incorporate more theory, more history, more literature from the African diaspora in the way that we interpret the archaeological work that we do in these communities.
Mm-hmm. And so when you're referring to the diaspora, what is the historical context behind enslaved Africans being brought to the Caribbean? How long is that history? Can you give us maybe a bite-sized review of the context and how many people were brought over to the United States and the rest of the Caribbean?
Yeah, definitely. So there's usually the last 500 years is really considered that time when historical archaeology focuses in, and that's really this sort of ramp up of the transatlantic slave trade. Officially, I believe they have documented records of around 12 million enslaved Africans that have made it over to the Americas as a result of the slave trade. Mm-hmm. Unofficially, those numbers are likely upwards of 20 million plus. And then there's a whole history behind the transatlantic slave trade, where people are coming from mostly West and Central Africa, but then also from Southeast Africa into the Caribbean, as well as South America. And then there's also histories of internal trades and migrations. There's histories of resistance built into that. There's histories of communities sort of developing their own autonomous spaces in there. And so what we're really trying to do is unpack all of that to get a more full and more complete experience of what that time period was like, and then also what the experiences were like for those that were enslaved and brought over here.
Mm-hmm. And when you're teaching classes about these things, what are some of the core lessons that you give to people, your students who are taking this for the first time and understanding the context of enslavement for the first time? Like, what are some main lessons that you bestow upon them?
Yeah, covering 500 years in one course, of course, is it's a big sort of big task and undertaking. But one stress is the life and the livingness and the ways that people made life in these contexts, because oftentimes we're presented with the transatlantic slave trade. It's often this period of doom and gloom and death. And we don't want to leave people with that feeling that this is all that happened. Mm-hmm. And then in addition to that, putting it sort of beyond showing that the human experience is more than just what the lived individual experience, but then also looking at all the ways the transatlantic slave trade affected environments, the way that it infected governments and political entities and countries and state formation and ideologies, mm-hmm. and all those aspects as well, because that often gets overlooked when we talk about the slave trade.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier that you had worked in a number of contexts. Do you bring that field work and excavation experience like into the classroom as well? And do you talk about that? So sort of give them, you know, case studies to contextualize this history.
Right, definitely. Archaeology, more than the fields, is one it's really tactile. It's really phenomenological, something that you need to touch and experience. And so as a result of that, I do try to bring in my own experiences. I try to use my own photographs and my own research when I'm explaining some of these broader concepts. Mm-hmm. And then more importantly, I also try to stress a lot of the work that I've done in Africa on the continent in doing this relationship, because we get a lot of information about the African diaspora in the Americas, but we don't really talk about archaeology in Africa that's complementing that research. Mm-hmm. So I try to bring both of those in to bear on the subject.
That's really interesting. And so I know that your most recent work is focused on the archaeology of St. Croix. Would you be able to give like a brief history of like the island and the process through which enslaved people were brought there?
Yeah, so St. Croix traditionally was known as Ai by the indigenous people. And so one of the things we're trying to do is also acknowledge, just as after the Haitian Revolution, you know, they renamed Haiti after the indigenous name. We're trying to look at more than just archaeology in terms of reclaiming a specific past, mm-hmm. and trying to look at it as a way to reclaim this longer historical past. So Ai is really, it's got a long history of indigenous Taino occupation, Salidoid. There's a number of different indigenous peoples that occupied this land first. Europeans really come in around 1493. And then there's a number of different ways in which different countries come together to bear on the island. So you have, at one point, the Knights of Malta controlled the island, the French controlled the island, the British controlled the island, and probably the group that gets the most attention are the Danes and the Danish Empire. Mm-hmm. And it's a unique experience, because oftentimes when we talk about slavery in the Caribbean, the Danes get left out. But they did own the St. John's, St. Thomas, and St. Croix, what is now the U.S. Virgin Islands. Mm-hmm. So some of the work we're trying to do is explore what that experience was like for enslaved Africans living under Danish occupation. Mm-hmm. And then also talking about some of the nuances of Danish colonialism, and then some of the legacies that persist today as it's now officially a U.S. territory, and problematizing this idea of colonialism ending sort of with the abolition of the slave trade, and talking about how it persists in some ways today with the current occupation and notion of St. Croix as a U.S. territory. Mm-hmm.
I think like in, you know, decolonial, like post-colonial theory, that's like called, that's what's known as like, you know, starting and finishing. And the decolonization movement has, you know, what some people would say has finished. But of course, there is still a lot of neo-imperial or neo-colonial processes that are still going on.
Right. And this is again why I stress it's often important that we continually draw from Caribbean scholars, because colonialism never ended, mm-hmm. a continuation of something that has persisted. So the ideas of post and neo, those are really terms that have been imposed from outside. Mm-hmm. So it's an interesting conception when we think of it that way. And then from the archaeological perspective, we look at this as a continuum in terms of the ways in which things that developed during those last 500 years as a result of plantation slavery, mm-hmm. persist today into the present. Mm-hmm. And that's some of the work that I'm trying to do now with the ecology and slavery, and looking at the environmental impacts related to that transatlantic slave trade.
Mm-hmm. It's fascinating and really important, I think. And when Denmark was there, were the, you know, the estates and where the plantations concentrated on sugarcane, other crops?
Yeah, one thing I stress often is that slavery and plantation slavery specifically were experiments. And so at different times over different periods, different crops were being grown and tested. cotton was grown for a short period in certain places on St. Croix. Sugarcane was definitely the dominant sort of crop that was grown, cash crop, and then the production of rum as well. And there's Cruzan Rum Factory still produces rum today. For those of you who drink Cruzan rum, it's got a long history of not only the rum production itself, but the plantation where the rum was where the sugar was grown is still there. And they still have their headquarters on that land. So there's a long history of this continuation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned that we want to understand more nuance, I guess, and more detail about the past experiences of enslaved Africans who once lived there or the African diaspora. I was wondering, how do you, what kinds of evidence are we looking at and what kinds of information are we trying to uncover about these lives?
Yeah, it's an interesting perspective. So really the material culture is one of the few avenues we have to explore what life would have been like. So in St. Croix specifically, we're excavating what would have been the enslaved village community on the estate Little Princess, which was one of the larger plantations on St. Croix. Mm-hmm. And we're really doing that to try to understand, you know, how their housing structures were built, how they made life outside of their physical house and in the wider sort of community and house complex. Mm-hmm. And then also looking at sort of what goods they had access to and different aspects around life and food access and those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. So those are things that we're trying to explore to sort of humanize this experience over time.
Mm-hmm. Do we get some sense of like the, you know, the families and the communities that they were building even in this context?
Yeah, well, even just the housing units themselves, they're sort of structured in these contiguous community blocks. The house itself was so small, it would literally only be used mainly for sleeping. Mm-hmm. And so we find that a lot of people made life outside of their physical house. In addition to that, we find sort of ceramics and tobacco pipes and other goods that are coming from all over the world. Mm-hmm. So whereas in the British Caribbean, you find mostly British ceramics, or the French Caribbean, you find mostly French, we find a mixture of all of these different ceramic assemblages and different tobacco pipes and everything coming into St. Croix. Mm-hmm. And that's partially because the Danes often maintain this free port sort of legislation, which allowed every colonial power to come and trade,
right?
Which was rare for many places in the Caribbean. Mm-hmm. The artifacts that are coming out of St. Croix really tell a story of many different communities coming to bear in St. Croix. And we find from the diversity in ceramics, with the diversity in pipe stems and other sort of artifacts, that there really was this culmination of goods coming in from many different colonial territories. Mm-hmm. Into St. Croix, as opposed to, let's say, the British Caribbean or the French Caribbean, where you find mostly British ceramics and artifacts and mostly French ceramics and artifacts. We really find the mixture here. And it also speaks to the mobility between these islands. Oftentimes, we sort of think of these islands as isolated spaces, but really there was a lot of connection and interplay going between these different islands.
That's really cool. Are we talking about in terms of the pottery, are we talking about like hundreds of sherds, thousands?
Yeah, we're talking about hundreds of sherds. We're talking about British-made ceramics, but then also locally made, what they call Afro-Caribbean wares that are coming in from other islands. And a number of archaeologists have recently been exploring this topic more fully, but there's this idea that just because something is quote unquote locally made doesn't mean that it was actually made on the island. Hmm. And there is likely a trade of these sort of low-fired ceramic pots that are coming from other islands.
And I imagine like this would have a lot of like social value and symbolic value. Were they using the pots as well for like day-to-day chores?
Yeah, most of the pots were used for cooking and storage. And then even today, you know, there's still pottery production in the Caribbean, particularly St. Kitts and Nevis, and some other islands as well. And those pots get traded throughout the Caribbean as well.
Mm-hmm. When I was reading your work online, I was really fascinated by this idea that you also want to look at the sort of interactions between like enslavement and ecology. And could you speak a little bit more about that? Like, is that something that a lot of people look at in terms of how enslavement in the Caribbean will affect, you know, the environment around them and the flora and fauna around?
Right. It's something that people have explored tangentially, but it's definitely growing in attention. And it's something that I came to sort of later as a result of this work in St. Croix. And that's mainly because I saw a number of community groups today grappling with issues of the environment and food insecurity and those sorts of topics. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to see sort of what that looked like historically in the archaeological record and if we could track some of these things. So part of the work I've been trying to do is understanding how these ecological relationships changed over time. And one, in the sense of environmental degradation, I mean, when you clear cut forests for plantations, mm-hmm. it causes excessive shoreline erosion, sheet erosion. It can lead to a number of other environmental impacts that spiral into that. Oftentimes when we talk about slavery, we immediately think of enslaved Africans being brought here and being put to work on plantations. But in St. Croix and in a number of other territories, there was at least 5 to 10 years of nothing but land clearing and terraforming or leveling the land mm-hmm. that was required before they could even start to plant. Mm-hmm. And so that's a whole other aspect of this transatlantic slave trade that doesn't really get talked about too much. Mm-hmm. So trying to explore that and then also explore what the legacies of that then mean as they persist into the present. Mm-hmm. St. Croix also has a tradition of their historic buildings being built with coral as opposed to stone.
Right.
And so there's a whole other tradition of coral mining that continued in and around this island. And other islands as well. And so then I'm trying to explore, you know, as a scuba diver, I'm interested in how these maritime and terrestrial environments relate to one another mm-hmm. and exploring then how these sort of ramifications of coral mining may have persisted or affected some of the coral reefs off of St. Croix. Mm-hmm.
That's really cool. And like I've always admired people who do maritime archaeology. I just think it's awesome that you have to get a scuba diving license to do your job.
I'm still growing. Yeah.
Is it something you find quite fun? And you know, what are the signs that we're looking for here when you're diving down, and what would be like a sign that or evidence of something has happened in a particular location around the island?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I think it's still very much in the early nascent stages. We're trying to figure out how we can actually get at this question of coral mining. One thing I'm actually working on now is trying to identify the specific species of coral that are used in the housing construction. Mm-hmm. And it's mostly brain coral, for those of you who know different species of coral. But trying to understand how those species sort of relate to the species that are currently in and around St. Croix. And if we can deal with sort of numbers and the prevalence of certain species to see how they would have been impacted by this excessive coral mining. Mm-hmm. There's also bathymetry data, and I'm not sure if it's feasible yet, but I'll be testing out to see if we can actually look at bathymetry data or the mapping of the ocean floor to see evidence of these coral mining scars.
Oh, wow.
If it was as extensive as I think it was, mm-hmm. I think there should be some evidence of sort of undulations underwater that could speak to coral mining.
Can you give me like an example maybe of like how archaeological research that you've done on the continent of Africa has helped inform what has happened in the U.S. Virgin Islands or in other parts of Central and Caribbean America?
Yeah, definitely. I think probably most important is just an understanding of African history, first and foremost, when we talk about the African diaspora. A lot of times when African diaspora historians and archaeologists talk about Africa, there is this sort of conflation of different cultural groups and different identities under an umbrella. So it's, you know, West Africa or Central Africa. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't often accommodate for all of the different nuance within that. Mm-hmm. And then all of the different temporal shifts. So whereas somebody may have been coming from a port in, let's say, modern day Ghana, depending on what time in terms of history they were coming from there, they may have actually come from other parts of West Africa and only come through that port. So oftentimes you have to be careful not to equate the port of departure with the identity of the individuals that arrived in the Americas. Mm-hmm. Also, there's a long tradition of colonial attempts at establishing plantations in Africa. And so there's a lot of connections then between the plantations that we look at in the Caribbean and potential plantations on the continent. Mm-hmm. And part of the future work I hope to do at some point, I don't know how soon it will be, but looking at sort of Danish colonialism in modern day Ghana mm-hmm. and seeing how those plantations line up and how, again, as an experiment, how there are some similarities and differences with how those things were handled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm mainly like a biological anthropologist, a bioarchaeologist. Do we find a lot of the human remains in these contexts?
It's interesting. We don't find a lot. Oftentimes we stay away from cemeteries and burials just in general. Mm-hmm. And they have been sort of demarcated in many Caribbean islands by trees. And so they have found at least one, likely two or three cemeteries on St. Croix, mm-hmm. That relate to the African diaspora. But ourselves as archaeologists and the community in general, we've sort of stayed away from the idea of excavating and exploring those cemeteries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense and important to be sensitive. Mm-hmm. So how often do you bring students out there to have them get some experience in archaeology?
Yeah, we run a summer program every summer, and that's usually from the end of June into July. Mm-hmm. And that's part of a collaboration we're working with the University of California system and HBCUs, Historically Black Colleges and Universities. Mm-hmm. And that's a collaboration with Dr. Cameron Monroe at UC Santa Cruz, Dr. Bill White at UC Berkeley, Dr. Ayanna Flewellen, who'll be coming into UC Riverside this year. Mm-hmm. And so we bring four HBCU students every year to St. Croix. Last year, we had a few extra students that we brought on. Mm-hmm. But the idea is to expose them to the field of archaeology, because most of these historically Black colleges don't have archaeology programs.
Yeah.
And this provides them an opportunity to see if it's something that they're interested in. And if they are interested in it, it gives them a leg up when they apply for graduate school. So that's one of the things that we've been pushing. So every summer, we normally bring about four undergraduate students. And then we work very closely with Dr. Alex Jones at Archaeology in the Community. And she's been actually training the local kids on island in archaeology. And these are mostly middle high school age students affiliated with the Caribbean Center for Boys and Girls, mm-hmm. Which is sort of like a summer program. And there's about 15 students that come through that program every year as well.
Yeah.
So we're trying to really hit all levels.
I know that in biological anthropology as well, there is a very severe lack of representation of Black and Indigenous and other people of color. Like,
right.
The more you go up the different levels of academia, and I just think it's really egregious. You know, thankfully, like, I know some people who are trying to make the change, but it's not fast enough, at least in my area of archaeology and anthropology.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, it's something you have to be very intentional about. And thankfully, you know, we were able to secure that funding from the University of California to host this program. But even still, it's something that we're trying to implement now. Whenever we do archaeology mm-hmm. projects, we're always trying to make sure that we have a training component as well as a media component. And the idea is that we'll be training younger people that even if they're not interested in doing archaeology long term, mm-hmm. they at least have a better understanding and appreciation for the cultural heritage in and around them. And then a media component to help get the word out there that, you know, these are young people that look like you that are doing archaeological work, and you can begin to think of yourself as potentially doing this in the future.
Yeah. Sort of like giving them a broad sense of how they can apply this knowledge and these methods and their understanding for like a wide variety of like occupations.
Right.
Mm-hmm. What do you think are some of the major challenges in Caribbean archaeology at the moment?
Yeah, that's a good question. Right now, I would say probably the two biggest ones are funding. Mm-hmm. A lot of these Caribbean islands are very expensive to do archaeological work on. And then the other one I would say are natural disasters, hurricanes, earthquakes. All of those sort of threaten not just the field season, but also threaten heritage sites themselves. Mm-hmm. And then to a certain degree as well, I would also say that development and tourism, depending on how it's activated and used, can also be perceived as a threat because there are, you know, many sort of resorts and even people that are trying to become expats moving to these islands often don't have the same sort of understanding of the heritage that they're and the history that they're coming into.
Right.
So I think there needs to be more work done in terms of that, in terms of educating and activating these different heritage and tourism networks mm-hmm. to build off of rather than replace the heritage that's on these islands.
Mm-hmm. I mean, going back to like the archaeology in the region being affected by weather, I know that the hurricanes have been very devastating, and I'd love to hear from you what the experience has been like for you and other heritage professionals working in the region.
Yeah, so hurricanes Irma and Maria were probably the two largest hurricanes that came through in recent times. I would say 1988, there was Hurricane Hugo, which also had a devastating effect on the island. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people equate these last two hurricanes with that hurricane. And it was detrimental, not just for the heritage sites themselves, but also for the communities. And so there were a lot of individuals that were displaced after these hurricanes. You know, people that had money and the opportunity often moved off island to the mainland United States. And so there was history and knowledge associated with them that's now been displaced. mm-hmm. from those communities. In addition to that, of course, the heritage sites have also been impacted. And what we've been doing now is doing actually photogrammetry work, doing these 3D recreations of some of these historic buildings mm-hmm. To try to understand what they look like now so that after the next hurricane or earthquake hits, we can do a second assessment and then begin to set up some sort of mitigation practice mm-hmm. moving forward to preserve and conserve these areas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is it tough for you emotionally? Is it tough for your colleagues?
Yeah. I mean, it's definitely tough on many levels. After Hurricane Irma and Maria hit, the hurricanes hit in September and we were back down there in December. Mm-hmm. And we had to be very strategic about when we went down because we didn't want to be an additional burden onto the community mm-hmm. that's trying to rebuild and getting access to food and water and all those things. Mm-hmm. But then also we wanted to make sure that we helped outside of archaeology itself. So, you know, even fundraising to give, you know, to give resources to community members was a big sort of a big push. Mm-hmm. It humanizes this whole aspect of the work that we do. You know, we don't just come in and do archaeology and write a report and leave, but we have relationships with people there.
Mm-hmm. The project that you're doing related to what you also had said about, you know, public perception and tourism. I mean, what do you think about current public consciousness and attitudes when it comes to, you know, media reports or everyday conversations about the history of slavery? Like, do you think that museums, tourist industry, are they doing enough to show this history in all its lights?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's getting better. There are a number of individuals based in the community that have really taken the charge in terms of developing tourism and aspects of the history of the Virgin Islands that really gets at these critical questions. Mm-hmm. So you've got his friend El Gerard, who runs Chant, which teaches, it's not just tourism in terms of the cultural sense, but also in the ecological sense, and runs tours for different groups and hosts community discussions. You've got Dr. Chinzira Kahina Davis, and she's been a real force in the Virgin Islands Center for Caribbean Culture. And that has been a sort of galvanizing force in recognizing, identifying, and promoting Crucian history and history of the Virgin Islands itself, as opposed to just the pan-Caribbean sort of identity. Mm-hmm. And so the different ways that they're actually bringing forth these histories and narratives of the uniqueness of the Virgin Islands. And I think they've been a big force in also having outside tourism organizations come in and say, okay, well, we need to do something that's similar to the work that they're doing, or we need to find ways to promote some of the work that they're doing. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a big influence as well. And they've been good at hiring individuals from the island as well mm-hmm. to participate in a lot of those tours and do a lot of that work.
Mm-hmm. I understand that you are involved with a lot of projects, especially like, you know, the Smithsonian's project on slave wrecks is, you know, really interesting. And you're also president and the co-founder of the Society of Black Archaeologists. How do you find like managing all of these different projects and different initiatives all at the same time?
Yeah, it's a lot of work. And I will say, I don't think I could have done it if I wasn't on a postdoc. So yeah. the ability to have the free time to do all of it sort of helps. And then I have a strong team behind like working with me collectively in all these different areas. And so in most of these projects, I'm just one member of a much larger group. And outside the Society of Black Archaeologists, you know, the other projects I sort of get called out to assist when I can, as opposed to spearheading projects. Mm-hmm. And so that helps as well. But I think the most important aspect of it for me is the ability to sort of galvanize resources and assist in projects that we wouldn't normally have access to or wouldn't normally be engaged in. I think right now is a critical time where there's a lot of attention on African diaspora history. And I think there's a really unique opportunity where students are really interested in exploring these topics. And I think if we can give them internship opportunities and show them the vast range of possibility that's available through archaeology, mm-hmm. It makes all this work with the Society of Black Archaeologists and the National Museum of African American History and Culture and the Slave Wrecks Project that much more rewarding.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I got the sense that like for all of these things, you are working in a big team and sort of distributes the workload mm-hmm. amongst many people. And that way you're able to sort of take part in all of these wonderful initiatives.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It kind of goes against other systems within academia and within research or heritage, where I think some researchers or some institutions kind of sort of emphasize, you know, individualism
right.
or to sort of go against that grain is to focus more on like communal efforts and collective action instead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. And I think that's something that we grapple with in addition, like specifically with this project in St. Croix. Myself and Dr. Ayanna Fluellen sort of conceptualized this project with a group called Diving with a Purpose. And the idea was to set up a youth training component which would focus on terrestrial archaeology, and a youth training component that would focus on maritime archaeology. Mm-hmm. And the seed funding was provided by the Slave Wrecks Project. But in establishing a terrestrial archaeology component, Ayana and I wanted to make sure that there was a sort of community-based understanding in terms of more of a sort of egalitarian way that PIs would be distributed, the principal investigators. And so myself and Ayana rotate the principal investigator position, and then we brought on Dr. Bill White, Dr. Elisa Odewale, and Dr. Alex Jones. And the idea is that all five of us are sort of consulted before we make major moves about the archaeology that's being done at the site. Mm-hmm. So it requires archaeology to move a little bit slower, but at the same time, it also gives all of us experience in managing a budget for a big project like this, mm-hmm. In terms of planning the logistics, in terms of thinking through what methods are going to be used and why. Mm-hmm. So that the idea is that as a few of us sort of filter off and go on to do our own projects afterwards, we still have capacity to continue the project. And now we all have the experience to bear on our future projects. And so the idea was not just to be a training program for youth and for undergraduate students, mm-hmm. but then also to have it be a training program for us as well.
Yeah.
As junior faculty.
That's really cool. When you're presenting like your work around at conferences or maybe visiting other institutions to give talks, has the reception to your work been quite good?
Yeah, it's been good generally. A lot of people ask the question about, because I use we a lot, because again, a lot of this stuff was done in collaboration with so many people. Mm-hmm. So there's been a lot of questions around, okay, well, what aspect of this project is your project? And so those sorts of ideas are getting more and more, I guess, they're bringing to light this idea of a different way of doing archaeology. Mm-hmm. And then there's also the issues of, you know, tenure and promotion in academia, where they're asking for single authored articles and journals and pieces.
For sure.
And so we had to be very intentional to play that game as well. So we sit down frequently and talk about, okay, what articles are you going to single author, and what articles are we going to collaborate on, mm-hmm. just to make sure that people hit the marks that they need to get their tenure,
yeah.
while we also build out this program in a collaborative way.
Mm-hmm. Even though, like, probably in your heads, you guys would like to just sort of submit them all and you're all first authors together.
Definitely, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, is this ever tiring for you? Is this ever stressful for you? How do you work through any challenges, like, in your day-to-day work?
Yeah, no, it definitely is. It's tiring and stressful. I think my birthdays for the last 5 years have all been in St. Croix in the field. So as a result of that, you know, I know it's not permanent, which is also one of the feelings that kind of keeps me motivated to do this work while I can. Mm-hmm. We have funding to do this work. We have the people that are interested in doing this work, and we have access to these sites to tell these stories. Mm-hmm. And I know that that doesn't last forever. So that's sort of my motivational factor behind doing this now. But moving forward, I mean, there definitely is a time period where I need to sit down and actually, you know, write up the analyses in a way that's presentable, mm-hmm. in a sort of monograph or book project, write up some of these articles, and find the free time to do all those different aspects as well.
Yeah. And I imagine, like, take a step back, reevaluate what you're doing and where you would like to go.
Right.
Yeah. Well, why don't you tell us what you're hoping to sort of accomplish maybe like in the next 5 or 10 years?
Yeah, that's a good question. So we've set up St. Croix to be a 5-year project. This year was intended to be year 4, but with everything going on, we'll likely have to push it back another year. Mm-hmm. So we'll probably have 2 more years of archaeology at the Estate Little Princess, doing some more ecological work. And bringing in different researchers. Part of what we're trying to do is make it more interdisciplinary. Mm-hmm. So bringing in ecologists, bringing in geographers, bringing in people from different backgrounds to also sort of weigh in on these questions. So I'm hoping to build that out over the next 2 years. And then working with the Slave Wrecks Project, there's some exciting projects and potential for projects coming up in Africatown, Alabama, in relationship to the Clotilda. But I won't go too much into detail on that. A lot of that's mm-hmm. still sort of early formation.
Cool.
But there's a lot of interesting history going on in the South now, looking at sort of the remnants of the slave trade, and then mm-hmm. also these communities that are built out of the Reconstruction era. Mm-hmm. And so that's another area that I'm hoping to explore a little further. Mm-hmm. And then continuing to do scuba diving work and maritime archaeology training. I work with an organization called Diving with a Purpose, which does these summer maritime archaeology survey field schools in the Keys, the Florida Keys. Mm-hmm. And so continuing to work and to build that out into a program that grows into something larger, I think is going to be interesting. Mm-hmm. And then in 2021, I'll be starting as an assistant professor of anthropology at UCLA.
And congratulations.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So part of that is also then trying to bring the resources to bear at UCLA to begin to get more graduate students to engage in this work as we expand out the field. Mm-hmm.
Do you think that there is, something about the sociopolitical context that we're in now that is driving public and funders' interest in, Afro-Caribbean and African-American history?
Yeah, I've been trying to understand this more and more fully. There is definitely more funding resources allocated to this, to historical archaeology in general, and then to the African diaspora more specifically. I think there's been a real push for asking of what archaeology's relevance is to communities. Mm-hmm. And I think historical archaeology is definitely more salient, and historical archaeologists have made the argument for a lot of their work being related to contemporary questions. So I think that that's pushed a lot of the funding. There has been a sort of uptick in wealth in Black communities, and the donors that are starting to contribute coming from these communities are rapidly increasing, whether we're looking at donors specifically to the National Museum of African American History and Culture, or donors that are trying to give back in the communities where they come from and trying to understand these broader questions. I think all of those are sort of coming to bear in a unique moment right now, mm-hmm. which is causing this increased attention in African diaspora archaeology. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I feel like by looking up your work online, I also get the sense that you really, you respond to that really well, and you respond to it in lots of different media. You know, what motivates that communication and that sort of outreach that you do?
Yeah, I think it's on multiple levels. One is that I have friends now that have children in 3 or 4 years old, and they're starting to tell them they're interested in archaeology and they don't know any other Black archaeologists. So they reach out to me. So I've done, FaceTime, Zooms and Skypes with kids that are just interested in this field. So I think getting the media out there is very important because it really drives interest in the field long-term later on. Mm-hmm. In the field of scuba diving, when you talk to a lot of older scuba divers about what got them interested in scuba diving, I would say 9 out of 10 times they talk about Jacques Cousteau.
Right.
And I think that we need to be more intentional about how we present our media and about presenting the archaeological work that we do to the broader media, mm-hmm. because it is driving preservation, it's driving future donors to the field, it's driving research, and so that's just one angle that I think that we need to sort of cultivate. Mm-hmm. And if we have an upper hand on it in terms of actually having control of the media outlets that we participate in, we're allowed to tell the stories in the ways we want to tell them, as opposed to just a sort of spotlight in between different segments mm-hmm. not related to our field. Mm-hmm.
I know that there was one thing that I had watched online, which was you were on a Netflix series called Explained, and I watched your contributions to the episode that was about pirates.
Oh, yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit about that? And, did they approach you or did you approach them? How do you get involved with something like a Netflix documentary episode?
Yeah. So the Netflix situation happened as a colleague of mine was actually approached first. And for various reasons, she wasn't able to participate. So she recommended me. Mm-hmm. And then it turned into a phone conversation about the research I'm doing and about some of the history of the relationship between pirates and the slave trade, which then led them to come down and film that that piece specifically. But yeah, it was definitely, it was a new sort of venue and avenue for me to explore. Mm-hmm. But I think the most important thing was seeing the response from that. For me, studying the transatlantic slave trade, the relationship between pirates and slavery isn't really a phenomenal idea. People have written about it, talked about it a lot, mm-hmm. but having the venue of Netflix and then getting the responses from individuals, finding me on Instagram or finding me on Twitter and commenting, I saw the special. Thank you so much. I'm interested in learning more. And so it really pulls in people outside of academia mm-hmm. into these broader discussions. And I think for topics as popular and as big as piracy, that's even more important because a lot of times you go to Disneyland or you watch Pirates of the Caribbean and you're not told to make this connection between the slave trade
no.
and mm-hmm. what it is that you're experiencing. Mm-hmm. And so I think these venues, Netflix and all these other popular media venues, are great ways to sort of retool people's ideas about what this looks like in relationship to the slave trade.
Is there anything particularly exciting about the Society of Black Archaeologists and the work that you're doing there coming up?
Yeah, definitely. So we've got our formal 501c3 nonprofit status early last year. And so we've been working to build out a more formal organization with actual official titles and with roles and responsibilities. And it's caused some interesting conversations in the field of archaeology as well, where a number of professional organizations are wanting to partner with us on related projects of capacity building, as well as community members from various communities reaching out to us, asking for assistance on researching sites in their community. So all of those things are sort of coming together in a unique and interesting way. And then we're also trying to provide ourselves as a resource for younger archaeologists that are coming up and interested in ways they can get involved. And, you know, we say we're the Society of Black Archaeologists, but we're for the wider community. And we have members that span the full spectrum, mainly people who are interested in African diaspora archaeology. But anybody who's interested in joining the listserv can reach out to us on our website and more than welcome to join, offer suggestions, and apply for membership as well.
Yeah, that's excellent. In terms of resources, what are like some examples of things that you're putting out there?
Yeah. So mostly for undergraduate students, we're trying to provide mentorship opportunities. So if they're interested in a particular field or a research question, we try to pair them up with some faculty members or some people who are doing work in those areas. So they have a sort of a guiding path to look forward to. In other areas, community members reach out to us about potential resources. So oftentimes if we're not available to do anything, we'll try to put them in touch with an archaeologist who's local to their specific area to see if they can even just offer recommendations as ways to move forward and assist with projects. And then wider academic organizations have been reaching out to us specifically in terms of capacity building. And I think that, again, these organizations realize there's a need to develop capacity outside of what traditional archaeology has represented. But they're not exactly sure how to tap into this wider pool of archaeology and sort of what to do to galvanize support. And so that's sort of where we come in and say, well, there are a number of people interested in this field, and these are the ways that you can begin to bring people into the fold.
Yeah. What does it mean to build up capacity?
For us, it's about being intentional about recruiting students and engaging students in the practice of archaeology itself. And so what we try to do is we try to expose everybody from, again, K through 12, as well as undergraduate institutions to the field of archaeology so that they can begin to see what a graduate program would look like. What is involved in the field of archaeology. You know, many people don't know the importance of having a PhD in archaeology in terms of leading archaeological excavations, and then exposing them to other aspects like maritime archaeology and the things that they need to get to become competitive for a maritime archaeology degree, and also the research that they're capable of doing with a degree in maritime archaeology.
Like in the UK where I was trained, or in Europe where I've mostly worked, like I am a Filipino Chinese guy who does archaeology, and I feel a lot of the time I do hear this narrative or this myth, I guess, that some people say, which is just that, you know, oh, Asians aren't interested in studying anthropology, or they're not interested in archaeology, which is for me just like not.
Right. It doesn't make sense. Right.
In Hong Kong or like Japan or wherever we're from, like we are very used to having very diverse societies. So of course we think about people, and everybody wants to know where they come from. Everybody wants to understand heritage and history. It's just that sometimes when you enter academia, especially like in like, you know, Euro derived like context, we aren't typically given a lot of resources. We're not equipped with the knowledge of how we can contribute and what the relevance is to our communities, but also like the wider community. We're just sort of not trained in the same way.
Right, right. And I think that's one of the things that we're finding, because we learn a lot from indigenous archaeologists. And in many ways, they're, you know, miles ahead of where we're trying to get as Black archaeologists. But they're, again, very intentional, not just about in terms of recruiting other indigenous archaeologists, but then also changing the way that archaeology is done. And I think that's where you begin to really galvanize support and get sort of new interest in archaeology, is because when they see that this is a way that you can do archaeology that's not only meaningful, but then also respectful and impactful in the community, that's when you say, okay, well, maybe I need to switch my disciplinary training and get into the field of archaeology. And I think that's where we're trying to get in Black archaeology. And we're hoping that, you know, other groups as well begin to pick it up and realize how you can activate archaeology as a tool to impact your communities in ways that are meaningful.
Yeah, I think that's really good. Thank you for sharing all of that.
Yeah, thank you.
If people want to ask you questions or like kind of find more of these videos, like I know that you have a lot of stuff on your website. Mm-hmm. Where can people find this stuff online?
Right. Yeah, I would say reach out to me through my website. That's justindunavant.com. And I'm sure we can provide a link in the show notes.
For sure.
And then, yeah, societyofblackarchaeologists.com to learn more about the archaeological work that we're doing as a wider organization and our partner members. The Slave Wrecks Project has their own website, which we can link to, where you can learn more about what the Slave Wrecks Project is doing. Mm-hmm. And then all the other groups I mentioned, the Virgin Islands, the Center for Caribbean Culture, the Chant organization, and all those other organizations all have their own websites as well. And if you're interested in getting involved, you know, reach out and ask about ways that you can assist. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of research that needs to be done for scuba diving and diving with a purpose. There's ways where the sort of lay scuba diver can get involved and participate in some of this work. And so I recommend sort of reaching out to different areas or venues that you might mm-hmm. be interested in.
So if people also want to reach out maybe via social media, are you around anywhere?
Yeah, I'm on Facebook, I'm on Instagram, I'm on Twitter, but don't use it too much. but the handle is @ArcFieldNotes, ARCH Field Notes. And yeah, you can reach out to me there and follow my antics.
And with every episode, I like to ask the guest if they can come up with a hashtag for the episode. Is there a good hashtag you can think of for this episode?
Oh, wow. Hashtag. That's a good question.
You're kind of like a secret for listeners so that they can indicate that they've heard all the way to the end.
Ah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see. Hashtag archaeology.
Okay. How do you spell that? And what's the meaning behind that?
So ARCH ecology, ECOLOGY. Mm-hmm. And the meaning behind it is sort of what we're trying to do is to pair these two ideas of doing archaeological work and ecological work mm-hmm. simultaneously. And so one of the things that we promote and I'm pushing now through this project is it's not just enough for us to understand the environmental impacts of the slave trade, mm-hmm. but then also to offer some sort of mitigation or redress for that, even though it's outside of our traditional field. So working with Diving with a Purpose, you know, we also do coral reef restoration. Because we realize that coral reefs have been heavily impacted during this transatlantic era. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to blend together this idea of cultural and natural history more fully in our practice. So mm-hmm. archaeology.
Cool. That's a good hashtag. Do you have any, do you think that there's anything that we haven't mentioned already? Do you have any closing messages?
I would say the biggest thing I try to promote to people is if you see a sort of field or avenue that you want to explore, I encourage people to explore it regardless of what your disciplinary boundaries tell you is possible. Hmm. And I think that that's important for us as archaeologists, because as archaeologists, we're often put in places and situations where the questions that we're asking and the sort of answers to those questions extend well beyond the field of what we've been trained as archaeologists to do. Mm-hmm. So I encourage more collaboration outside of disciplinary boundaries, and then also encourage people to explore their curiosity beyond that as well. Mm-hmm. So I've been starting to read more literature, more poetry from people from these places, talking about their experiences in these places, mm-hmm. But then also talking to marine scientists and trying to understand sort of what questions they're grappling with on the island as mm-hmm. well.
I think that's really good advice, because I feel like academia kind of, you know, it's like designed to sort of make you very narrow-minded, and the further you go along it, you can sort of get lost in one particular area, but then you forget the wider applications or the wider connections you can make to other people working on maybe not like, you know, very directly related things, but still there's always insights you can gain from other people.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Working in teams is probably most important of all of it.
Mm-hmm. So listeners, if you want to let us know that you have heard the episode, then find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Reddit at Arcananth Pod. Thank you so much to the patrons of the show who keep the show going. If you want to become a patron of the show as well, then go to patreon.com/arcananthpod and find all the options for how you can support the show. New episodes come out every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, and arcananth.com. Justin, thank you so much for joining me on today's episode.
Thank you.
Yeah, all the best with all the things that you're doing. All of it sounds great, and wishing you all the best.
Oh, I appreciate you. Thank you.
Okay, so listeners, I'll have another episode out for you soon. Goodbye.
Bye.